From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler.
Even though Kevin Boyle received his PhD from the University of Michigan, he teaches 20th century American history at The Ohio State University. His emphasis on class, race, and politics, as demonstrated by his most recent book, Arc of Justice, A Saga of Race, Civil Rights, and Murder in the Jazz Age, has won, among other things, the National Book Award for Nonfiction and the Chicago Tribune Heartland Prize, as well as it was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award. Welcome, Dr. Boyle, to Writer's Talk.
Thanks for having me.
I'm glad you're here. Part of the reason that you wrote Arc of Justice is because you spent a year abroad as the Mary Ball Washington professor at the University College Dublin, where your students were particularly engaged with civil rights. And you grew up in Detroit, so you were familiar with the story of Dr. Sweet, which is chronicled in here. And you've said that the racial tensions in the city led you to your interest in race relations. Tell me, what's your elevator description of Arc of Justice?
What Arc of Justice does is it tells the story of one incident, one event in Detroit in 1925. In the September of 1925, an African-American doctor and his wife moved into an all-white neighborhood on the east side of Detroit. The second night they're there, there was a violent incident. A mob came to drive them out of their house. They tried to defend themselves. The result was the death of one member of the mob. And then what Arc of Justice does is it takes that terrible incident, that one moment, and it moves back in time to say what brought those people into that house and that mob around the house. And it goes forward in time to say, and what happened to these people after that terrible incident.
Okay. And the novel is written so that it reads almost more like fiction, because like you're saying, it's not a linear chronology. You don't start with Dr. Sweet's family and then move forward to it. You've got the scene that's being set and some of that, and then you move backwards and forwards. How do you feel that adds or detracts to the writing of history? Because that seems not typical academic history writing.
No, I didn't set out to make this book typical academic history writing. What I wanted to do was I wanted to write a book that hopefully other historians are going to read, but was aimed at a general audience. And one of the classic ways of doing that is the same way that you teach a class. When you teach an undergraduate class, you don't give them historiography up front. You don't give them all the other books written about your topic. You tell them a story. Stories are what draw people in. It's what drew me into history. And so what I wanted to do was write a book that read like a story. And the obvious thing for me to do, it seemed obvious at the time anyways, is to start with the most dramatic moment in mm-hmm. that story.
Mm-hmm. And then it moves on to the trial, which was a huge trial, and it had some enormous lawyers fighting for it.
The Sweets are very ordinary people. He was a physician, and they had the enormous luck after this terrible incident that the NAACP, the leading civil rights organization in America then and now, came to their defense. And then the NAACP hired this lawyer. They had trouble finding a decent lawyer. It was before the days of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund when they had their own lawyers. They went out and hired a lawyer. And they got this decent lawyer for them. It was a guy by the name of Clarence Darrow, which was essentially hiring the greatest defense attorney in 20th century American history.
Mm-hmm. Even though you point out that some of his greatest cases he didn't necessarily win.
Oh, no,
he didn't win in the courtroom.
Tendency to lose his cases. And in some ways, his proudest achievements are making sure that his clients don't end up in the electric chair.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the title of the book comes from a quotation by the abolitionist Theodore Parker that goes something along the lines of, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice." And I was really interested in that, not just because it was the contributed to the title of the book, but because historians usually focus on bad things, on traumatic events, right? You've got wars, injustice, violence. And this seems like a remarkably positive notion for a historian.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I'm one of those people who tends to dwell on the negative, and the title's a little tricky that way. The background really is that my editor and I, as we were working on the book, we couldn't think of a decent title for this book. And we had 10 million titles for this book, and they, one after another, and they were terrible, terrible titles. And it was getting close to publication, and really, as a marketing tool, not having a title for your book is really detrimental.
Yeah.
So we decided...
The Beatles did it with the White Album, though.
Yeah, but they were the Beatles, and it took them 3 or 4 years to figure out how to do that. I mean, they had Ed Sullivan behind them. Mm-hmm. We didn't have Ed Sullivan behind us at the time. And that phrase that you just said, which was really made famous by Martin Luther King, it was something he said all the time in his speeches, came to me as a very powerful description of the hope of race relations. But the tricky part is that Arc of Justice is not a particularly hopeful book. Mm-hmm. And so I loved the majesty of that phrase, of Arc of Justice, but it didn't actually match the story particularly well. So we took that because we really needed a title to put on this book. But at the very start of the book, what I did was I gave people the quote that you read, and then I put beneath it a poem from Langston Hughes that goes, "The justice is a blind goddess is a thing to which we blacks are wise. Her bandage hides two festering sores that once perhaps were eyes." Mm-hmm. And my goal in that one page was to counterbalance the positive side. So I have to plead guilty to being one of those depressing historians.
Okay. Just at parties when historians are sitting around, do you tell more hopeful stories than the books you write? Or is it all just depressing?
We don't have parties.
Okay, that explains it.
And if we did, we just drink.
Okay, great. So tell me about how you see it playing out in the book, though. I'm curious, you know, you've got the double... quote at the beginning of the book that allows you that sort of wiggle room when you're talking to somebody like me. But do you feel ultimately at the end of a saga of race, civil rights, and murder in the jazz age that there was an arc of justice, or are you still hopeful just some other time that that'll work out, but not in this story?
It's a great question. There is an arc of justice. There is the arc that struggles towards justice, and this is very much a book about people trying to do the right thing, mm-hmm. trying to overcome an incredibly powerful system of segregation. It's a northern system of segregation. It's not the one we normally talk about. It's a segregation of neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And there is a hopeful arc in that people like Dr. Sweet, people like Clarence Darrow, tried to crack that system of segregation. What isn't hopeful, and what in the end I think makes the book more a tragedy, is that that system of segregation doesn't crack, that we actually live today, and this ties in to your point earlier about growing up in Detroit, we live in a society that maintains neighborhood segregation. American cities are still overwhelmingly segregated places, and Detroit is the most segregated city in America. And that's not in 1925, that's not in 1965, that's today.
Okay. So when you're doing research for this book, and it's exceptionally heavy on footnotes, endnotes, because you're following, is this Turabian style?
Got me.
You've got in the back of it all the footnotes, so you've got all the things that you've done. Were you able, tell me about doing research that was more with people. I'm curious whether, I think that there are a couple people you talked to who were alive peripherally at the event. There are daughters and sons and grandsons of people.
There really were two really, really critical moments of research that had nothing to do with visiting archives or libraries. One is that the family that now lives in the Sweets house in Detroit, and they've lived there since the 1950s, they invited me in to see the house. I didn't do anything to arrange this. Detroit's only 1 million people, and it operates like a small town. So the son, who's about my age, of the family that lives in that house, he heard through various ways that I was working on this book, and he just sent me an email one day and said, you know, my parents live in this house. You want to come see it? Wandering through that house, walking into every inch of that house, they were really incredibly nice to me, transformed the way I saw this story, because it's a story about people trapped inside that house with this mob or outside them, and standing in that upstairs bedroom, realizing that they were looking down at a mob that was 20 feet away. You could just feel the terror of that. The other critical moment came when I went down to Dr. Sweet's hometown, which is a little town in central Florida, Bartow, Florida. And through a whole series of blind luck, really, I got to meet Dr. Sweet's baby brother. Mm-hmm. Now, I use that term in a particular way because the man was 89 at the time. Mm-hmm. But he very kindly invited me in to talk about his family, to talk about his brother, to talk about this whole experience. And that was just absolutely transformative, to have that connection with the family. And someone who knew him, as only really a brother can know someone, that was absolutely fabulous.
What kind of things did you take from that interaction?
I'll give you he spent the whole afternoon with me, which again was incredibly kind of him, but I'll give you the one key moment in it. When I first got there, he was kind of nervous about this. He didn't know me, and we had been introduced through an intermediary, and he wasn't quite sure whether he could trust me or not. And I asked him early on, what happened to your brother? What did this incident do to your brother? And he said, nothing. Didn't have much of an effect at all. And I thought, that's really strange.
It's an interesting comment.
Right. So we kind of switched to other topics. We talked about family and family history. We talked about his parents. We talked about his growing up. Sherman Sweet, had lived in Cleveland most of his adult life. So we chatted about that a little bit. And then after we got more comfortable, we circled back to that question. And I guess asked him again, did it have any effect at all on your brother? And it said it destroyed him.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems reading the history of them afterwards that's what the kind of thing you would expect. What happened to him after the trial, which actually went rather well.
Right. That's the arc of justice.
Surprisingly.
Amazingly.
Amazingly, the lawyer actually won in the most part. And so what had happened to him was really interesting. He held onto the house for a while, though.
Oh, for a long time. And really, he sells it. A little complicated, but basically he sells it to the family who live in it today.
Mm-hmm. What is their understanding of the history of it?
Oh, they're very conscious of the history of it, which is really why they were kind enough to invite me in. Mm-hmm. They feel, I'll give you another quick story. The woman who owns the house, who is Mr. and Mrs. Baxter. Mr. Baxter has since died, but Mrs. Baxter is still there. And she's, I don't know, I'm going to guess in her 80s. And I was sitting with her. I've talked to them a number of times. I was sitting in her house one day, sitting on the sofa. And we were just chatting about what the house meant to her. And she said that what she really felt is that she raised her family in that house, which she did. She had a number of kids all raised in the house. In a way that Dr. Sweet never got to raise his family in that house.
Mm. When you're a white guy like me, and you go into writing about race relations, and you go to talk to people like this, that must be an interesting way to approach things as an author. Because everybody brings something to the table, no matter who you are. But it's always seemed to be a very interesting dual role that you play as a historian, or when you're somebody writing about race relations. Has that been a difficult thing to negotiate, or
maybe naively, I was worried about it when I went into the project because I really wanted to write a book that got at the real heart of a human experience. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just about abstractions. It wasn't just about the fact that Dr. Sweet fit this category or that category. It's about writing about a human being. And I did worry that as a white guy, that I didn't have an understanding. I couldn't get an understanding of that experience. I worried that as someone who came from a very different background, I couldn't have that experience. Someone coming from a different era, I couldn't have that experience. Mm-hmm. But what I found was that the communities that I connected with in Bartow, in Detroit, opened up so much to me and were so generous with me that I felt as if I was able to some degree, never completely, but to some degree pass through a few of those barriers. Mm-hmm. And I was very worried actually about the reception of the book. I mean, here's this white guy writing about civil rights, writing about the black experience. And I got to say that people have been just incredibly kind about that. I've never had, since the book came out, I've talked to an awful lot of groups, but since the book's come out, I've never had a bad experience with someone. Lots of people ask me, what's a white guy doing writing this book? But no one ever has said that I shouldn't have.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I know that there are other ways of approaching race relations and white privilege, and there are things like that I've always thought had this rather interesting take on it that I've never been able to as a person write about. But I'm really interested in that sort of experience.
You're listening to Writer's Talk from the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University. Our guest tonight is Ohio State University Professor of History, Kevin Boyle. If you'd like more information about race relations, attend the Transforming Race Conference on March 11th through 13th in Columbus. Surf to transforming-race.org to register to attend. And now, back to Professor Boyle.
tell me about the success of this book and its impact on your writing. As you go to write your next books, which we'll talk about in a little bit, how does that play in? Are you taking techniques that you'll utilize again? What's going on there?
Oh, I loved writing this book. I mean, writing this book was liberation to me. Mm-hmm. Because when you're in grad school, you're taught to write in a particular academic style. And when you're writing your first book and you're worried about tenure, you're writing in a particular style and you're hitting your marks. This was the book you write after tenure. And it was liberating to me to say, look, it's got adjectives. It's got adverbs. It's got character. It's got plotting. It's about seducing readers to want to get to the next page. That was my goal. I had this image in my head of a reader sitting in bed with this book and saying to himself, gosh, you know, it's 11:30. I really got to go to bed, but I got to finish this section. That's not how I was taught to write in graduate school. And so it was just so much fun to do this. Not every day. I don't find writing an easy process, believe me. Right. There are a lot of days where this is not fun at all. But the entire experience was just so liberating that the new project that I'm working on, I can't imagine writing them a different way.
Why do you said that that's not the way you're taught to write in grad school. And, you know, without getting myself into a lot of trouble, that's probably not the way I was taught to write in grad school. Why do you think that
it's a great
we've created these systems that work like that for writing? I mean,
I think it's a tough question. In a lot of ways, at least in history, which is the only experience I know, what we've done is we've kind of laid claim to our expertise. I'm a historian and you're not, by adopting kind of the languages of science, and then adopting kind of the jargon, the technical language that sets us apart from other people.
To prove that you've really got the...
establishes your ground.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I don't think that that's, for me personally, I have nothing against academic writing. I've done more academic writing than I've done this.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, the great joy of writing is to connect with the reader, not to distance myself from that reader. And that's what this tried, at least, to do.
So how do you do that in classes? Now that you've got this experience and you're valuing this, how do you go into your students? And I have a colleague in history, actually a former student, no names, and who told me, A, you've got waiting lists for your class, which is unusual, and B, that it was a great experience, although it was challenging. Exceptionally challenging.
Cool. It made my day.
Right. Well, I'm not going to use the phrase that was described difficult as heck. And so how do you negotiate that? If are you teaching academic writing to these students, or you're teaching the more in kind of writing that may be more engaging to a general public?
Well, I do both undergrad and graduate teaching.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, this is the worst sales pitch I have ever made for this book. In many ways, this book is an undergraduate lecture. It's a very, very long undergraduate lecture.
Yeah, it's a bit.
Because what you do in an undergraduate lecture is you got to grab the students right off the bat, first 5 minutes of a class. If you get up and you don't grab them the first 5 minutes of class, then you have a lot of sleeping students in your classroom, and the next day you don't have half of them. So you want to grab hold of them. You want to use storytelling as a way of hooking the history onto them and drawing them in. And that's what this book does. In a lot of ways, it's the teaching that taught me to write this book. It's not the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
Grad teaching is a very different thing, because in some ways what you're trying to do, I'm not advocating for this, but in a lot of ways it's the nature of the beast. What you're doing is you're teaching the grad students how to become professionals, how to hit those marks.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a little tricky to say what we really want to do is break those marks, stand over here instead of over here.
Mm-hmm.
And I worry about that a little bit, but I've just decided, if the department is happy enough with this, that what I really would love to do is teach a class on the grad level about writing history. Because more and more academics, it's not a huge trend, but more and more academics are saying, why do we want to write books that nobody reads? Let's write books that will reach an audience and then build on it. That's what all those footnotes or endnotes are sitting there for. Build into that the history stuff that the depth of history that our fellow academics want to see. Let's have them work to pull out the history, the historiography part,
mm-hmm.
instead of making the general reader work so hard to find the story that he gives up and goes to sleep instead of finishing off the section.
You know, there were two thoughts that occurred to me when you say that. The first was, I was wondering if the word historiography was going to come out at some point.
Yeah.
So I'm like, oh, this, because then you've laid claim to the academic.
Exactly.
Then there's your jargon.
Yeah,
you're
I think it's
about.
Interesting that when you type historiography into Word, that it's underlined. It's not a word.
Right. Well, and the other part is that what kind of reactions do readers give you to the footnotes? Because that, to me, stands as this is really an academic book. I've interviewed other people that have written books like Tony Horowitz that are, you know, more accessible. And he does a lot of storytelling, but not a lot of footnoting. How does that...
Footnotes are really important to me, partly because I wanted people to know that they could trust this story. That one of the trickiest things that happens in nonfiction is that blurry line between what's true and what the author has decided to add in. Mm-hmm. I didn't want that blurry line. I wanted it to be absolutely clear that what I was saying, I was drawing from the material of the past. Now, I figure most people, they don't look at the footnotes. You know, they're at the end, you skip over them. You know, and if they don't want to look at them, that's cool with me. But if there's any doubt in anybody's mind, where did he get that from? That's what the footnotes are there to do.
You know, that's funny because one of my comment or my joke about Turabian footnoting style, or which is based off Chicago or whatever, is that I've always thought there was an interesting rhetoric involved, or this sort of an argument in using footnotes and endnotes, because that establishes you as, you know, somebody who's doing this. But there's also this big difference between endnotes and footnotes, in that footnotes I always read. It's a compulsion. Yeah. You know, I'll always read the footnote. But when it's in the end note and you've got to flip back to
it. You think, oh, this takes too much of a hassle.
Right. You know, I'm wondering whether things like when you get your Kindle version of this, whether you can tap on that footnote and it takes you
right to that. Yeah, it's a good question, actually.
I have one.
I have a clue, but it's a good question.
I'd like to own one if anyone wants to give me one. But so you've got... A lot of influences going into this. I think one of your influences, two of your influences, J. Anthony Lucas and Sidney Fine, under whom you did your academic work at U of M. What other recommendations do you have for historical writers? Who else do you follow and think this academic or even non-academic has really got it?
I think J. Anthony Lucas, of course, is kind of the classic, everyone's favorite nonfiction writer. He's kind of the Bible of nonfiction writing with Common Ground, which is won the Pulitzer Prize a number of years ago now. I love Taylor Branch. Taylor Branch wrote this massive three-volume history of America in the Martin Luther King years. It's just brilliant, brilliant narrative history. But what I also find myself doing all the time is reading fiction. I think that sitting down with a brilliantly crafted piece of fiction tells you how to tell a story.
Who's on your nightstand?
Here's what I'm doing. I find myself doing all the time. I work in my study at home, and my wife and I have put the fiction out in the living room, which is right next to the study. So every time I get myself stumped, I walk in to there and I flip through a handful of books. I think I'm starting to memorize some of these books now. And the ones that I've become most obsessed with recently, let me think. Andrea Barrett, The Voyage of the Narwhal, which is just a kind of brilliant, brilliant bit of storytelling. Bel Canto, which is just a gorgeous book that weaves in kind of character development in a way that most of us would only dream of being able to do. Every once in a while, E.L. Doctorow, The March, because there's this kind of very tight storytelling. And of course, it's an historical novel, so that kind of helps a little bit too, with a kind of economy to that storytelling. So just look at how it is that people who have real talent as writers, believe me, I'm not claiming to have, but people who really have that craft of writing, how do you put a story together? How do you build character? How do you keep things paced correctly? Mm-hmm. You don't have to look at other works of history to do that. You got to look at people who have really, really tremendous skills.
Storytelling skills. You've got two other books you're working on. We're running out of time, but I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about The Splendid Deal, An American Ordeal, which I believe is about Sacco and Vanzetti, the anarchists, and Change is Going to Come, America in the 1960s. You're working on two books here. This is sort of academic ADHD. You're jumping around.
Yeah, that's exactly my life story,
so,
right there.
Okay.
I think that should be on my CV.
Tell me about these two books. What are they going to do? What are they going to add?
Well, what The Splendid Dead does is it revisits one of the better known stories of the 20th century, but I'm trying to tell it in a completely different way. And so what I'm trying to do is take the story of really Bartolomeo Vanzetti and to use his story to talk about what I think are some of the most important dynamics of the 20th century. It's about immigration. It's about poverty. It's about the making of political extremism. It's about the nature of terrorism. And it's about how the state, how the government responds to terrorism, defends what it sees as defending its core values in ways that corrupt those core values. Okay. That's the story that runs through The Splendid Dead. The Change is Going to Come is a history, very straightforward kind of history of the 1960s that comes literally from teaching. I teach a course at OSU on the history of the 1960s. What I want to do is I want to take that storyline that I've been developing in that course and transform it into book form.
Okay. And OSU will figure in that because it had a tumultuous time in the 60s at OSU.
It had a little bit of bumpiness there.
Yeah, a little bit. That's why we are just now getting back the brick sidewalks.
That's right. It's about time, I think. I think that we're well past it. I'm pretty confident of saying it.
Okay, great. Well, Kevin Boyle, I want to thank you very much for being here on Writer's Talk. Again,
thanks,
the book
for having me.
Is Arc of Justice.
So if you're an OSU student, you can always take Professor Boyle's courses. Of course, you're going to have to wait through the wait list for it. Join us next time for Tariq Terry, a speaker at the Transforming Race Conference in Columbus on March 11th through 13th. Surf over to transforming-race.org for more information on that conference. Until next time, this is Doug Dangler at Ohio State University saying, keep writing.